Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect Radio for the week beginning Sunday the 15th of August. This week we delve into the somewhat murky history of Bristol City Council's provision for amateur and semi-professional drama groups. Your host, John Peters Coleman, will be chatting to Alan Cross, editor of Prompt magazine. He'll also be chatting to Colin Power, recently returned from troubadour duties in Qatar, and he'll be talking about orgone energy, courtesy of Wilhelm Reich. We'll also be hearing from Karen De La Peña from the Edinburgh Festival. She was raised here but ran away to the USA to become an actress, and she's now back in Edinburgh with a one-woman show. We'll be hearing from Julian Lee Jones for the Temple Local History Group. We've got some mobile phone tips, news on a choir seeking singers of all abilities. We have music from Doc Satori. Malcolm Green will be reading another extract from Secrets and Lies, and Tim Burrows will be bringing us some more poems. And also, of course, not forgetting Jeff Sparks' What Song Guide. Well, it's over to you, John.
Well, I'd like to welcome Alan Cross on the line now. He's a long-time thespian and now the editor of the Avon Association of Drama's monthly Prompt magazine. Hello.
Good evening.
So how did you first get into amateur dramatics? How far is this going back?
Well, I'm currently, I just had a birthday a couple of weeks ago, I'm 77, and I've been doing drama since I left school. So we're talking about sort of 60 years.
Wow, okay. I'm imagining basically the answer to this might be no, but has it changed a lot over the past 60 years, AmDram?
Only in as much as we hate the word AmDram, but we like to call ourselves non-professionals, it's changed that the techniques have got better, and a good amateur production these days can match up to a good professional production.
Okay, so the only real difference is just that you're not getting paid as such to do it.
Well, no, exactly. We do it, I suppose you might say it was for a hobby. There are some people who are frustrated non-professionals, but other people like myself, I've done a couple of bits of professional work throughout my life, but I've always been an amateur and quite happy to be that.
Okay, do you find that a lot of people who get into amateur dramatics and non-professionals stay on purely because they like doing non-professional work, or do some people use it as a staging post to try and...
Well, the youngsters started using it as a staging post, bless them. The 16-year-olds will come in, get a bit of experience, and then go off to drama college when they're about 18.
Yeah.
And then hopefully get into the professional world. But the older people like myself that started 50, 60 years ago go on until we're no longer able to go on. You know?
Yeah. I was really interested in asking about the Little Theatre. We chatted about this on the show last week, and I've been in Bristol for a good decade, and I've never even heard of it.
Right. Well, now, the Little Theatre, obviously, is no longer with us. It used to be right by the side of the old Colston Hall, owned by the council, and it dates right back. I mean, I've got records of, in 1941, a professional touring group called the Rapier Players did a play called Cat's Cradle. That was in 1941.
Yeah.
So it dates right back to there. It actually closed, I'm not sure exactly whether it was the end of the 80s or the beginning of the 90s, purely because it fell into disrepair and the council warranted that it was too much money to put it back. But it had a beautiful stage, which was a revolving stage. In 1978, I actually performed there. The Avon Association of Drama do their annual production, which has now become outdoor. We just finished one at Blaise Castle a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
But the very first Avon production was in the Little Theatre in 1978, directed by one of our local ladies, and it was called Tom Jones.
Okay, do you find that the closure of the Little Theatre has presented you with a problem since its closure in finding venues that are easily accessible to people to put your productions on?
Very much so, because the thing is that with the Little Theatre, from the 40s onwards, it was all touring professionals. And then when we got into the 60s and 70s, several of the local amateur groups here in Bristol, apart from Avon Association of Drama, there was Headley Players, Block, Bristol Light Opera Company, people like that used it. And of course, when it was closed, there is now nowhere that good amateurs can use in Bristol. The only big amateur people, Block, Bristol Light Opera Company, they actually use the Hippodrome. Well, that seats over 2,000 people, as you know, so that's a hell of a task. But they do it biannually, not every year, sort of every 2 years, and they manage to survive on that. But there's no other amateur group now. We just have to fend for ourselves and use our own church halls and whatever. Yeah.
Do you find that somewhere like the Little Theatre gave you the option to be taken more seriously if you had a dedicated theatre?
Oh, absolutely, yes, because there was a following there that went to see the professionals. They were good start. I mean, I can remember seeing Sir Michael Horden and Felicity Kendall back in the 70s doing a play there. So it had a following in as much as that the Hippodrome's got a following now. And, of course, when amateurs were able to step in there because it was within our financial reach, it was a great boost, and you always got good audiences.
Brilliant. I obviously imagine a lot of protest was put up at the time, but what promises did Bristol City Council make when it was closed?
Nothing really. It was just announced that it was going to be closed. We put in all sorts of protests and tried to raise money and all the rest of it, but after lots of arguing and bickering, it just died. They did make a promise then, which has always upset a lot of people, including myself, of providing somewhere else for the amateur people, but it never happened. There was a theatre built over in Cannon's Marsh, which is now what you call Millennium Square. But that turned professional, and we've had people like Shirley Bassey and all the other lovely people there, but nothing for the amateurs.
Right. What are the prospects for it being able to be reopened then, do you think, if at all?
Well, now that they've done the new Colston Hall, as you know, the old piece, which is at the bottom of Colston Street with the steps up, where the booking office used to be, it's defunct at the moment because of the glory of all the new place that has been recently opened. So there isn't any chance of that being opened again.
OK. Well, what about access to more well-known theatres like the Hippodrome, I mean, or the Old Vic? How would they take proposals to put non-professional productions on?
Well, the Hippodrome has just changed hands again to another company. These big theatres are owned by professional companies, and they put on professional productions because that's the only way they can fill the theatre. If one of the local amateur groups decided to book the Hippodrome for a week, for a start, it would be an awful lot of money, which will be out of the reach of most people,
yeah,
as I say, apart from the Bristol Light Opera Company.
I understand you have a long-term association with the Bristol Evening Post. Do you have any associations like that with other bodies at all that you could...
In Bristol, we have the Rose Bowl Awards every year,
okay,
which is like the Amateur Oscars, held down at the Winter Gardens in Weston-super-Mare. We always have a celebrity guest to come along and give out the awards. We get money from the Hippodrome for that, and from the Evening Post, and from lots of other people that sponsor us on that one. And you can, on occasions... get work at the tobacco factory and in the studio in the Old Vic, but not in the main theatre as such.
Right, OK. So what do you reckon for the chances of seeing some amateur drama in the city centre, do you reckon, these days then?
The chances of actually seeing it on the city centre as such are not very good. But in our area, which is Bristol, Baines, which is Bath and North East Somerset,
yeah,
and South Gloucestershire, there are over 120 non-professional groups. And we all have our little places where we perform, and there's a lot of good theatre going on. But if you're talking about actually coming down in town to see it, well, there just isn't anywhere, unfortunately.
Okay, well, on a more positive note, I guess, I mean, you must always be getting new people that are interested. What sort of advice do you have for people who are nervously thinking about it, possibly? They're a bit interested in doing some drama,
well,
maybe not sure what to do.
If they're youngsters, they're hoping in the future to go into the professional world, do, for goodness sake, join your local group, because you go along there. When you leave school, you'll get a good starting background. You'll then get advice on how to apply to go to theatre schools. And then older people or middle-aged or whatever, if you've never been on stage or whatever, all the groups are welcome people, no experience at all, because we all have training programs that we do. And if you don't want to be on stage, you'd like to be backstage. There's always something, and it's a great hobby, whether you act or you don't act. And if you haven't got anything to do in the evenings except watch television, for goodness sake, go out and join one.
So, okay, that's brilliant advice. Do you have enough people turning up to be writers, or to be most people just want to be hogging the spotlight, as it were?
Yeah, last year we had a playwrights competition in Bristol. We had 14 people submit plays. I wouldn't say it's a vast amount, but there's a good, healthy bunch of amateur writers in Bristol, yes.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been brilliant to have you on. Now, tell me just a little bit why people should get Prompt Magazine.
Well, the whole point of that is it's organised by, as you said, Avon Association of Drama. You might say, who the hell are they? Well, we are the blanket organisation looking after all the local amateur groups. And the whole point of fact is that if you want to know what's going on, that's the idea of getting... Now, if you belong to a drama group, you will see the copies of Prompt circulated. If you don't, just for £12 a year, you can get the copies sent directly to your home once a month. It gives you all the local information on what's going on in our area. It also gives articles about things that you have to do, such as if you're using a gun on stage, you have to contact your local police station and advise them. Lots of interesting advice like that. But the main thing is, it's like your programme. It's a what's on programme. It lets you know what's going on.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Alan Cross. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And
just quickly before I go, if anyone is interested, would you give them my telephone number?
I will indeed, yes. What is your number?
It's 0117, of course.
Yep.
985.
Okay.
3631.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'd like to welcome to the studio now, fresh from troubadouring and travelling around Southeast Asia, Colin Power. Hello.
Hello. Right, so you've been back in the UK a little bit, so your tan has faded slightly.
Yes, the rain has washed it away a little bit, but I've heard that the summer was good before I arrived.
Well, I think we are going to have a little bit more of it coming up.
Oh, good.
So don't despair. But tell me a little bit. The last I heard of you, when I waved you off about 6 months ago from the studio, you were travelling to an island in Saudi Arabia where you were going to be employed as a troubadour and guitarist to liven up a new country that had been created that was rather cultureless. Explain this a little bit more briefly.
Yeah, no, it was playing on one of those man-made islands, you see. They're trying to create a little bit of kudos, I suppose. Yeah. That's the word, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay. What was it called?
It's called the Pearl Qatar. The country is actually Qatar, not Saudi Arabia. But
okay. Oh, sorry, boy. Yeah.
But people do get confused. Actually, it's a little country that's actually just off of Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
So a very close connection there, but it's a country unto itself.
How did bringing some kudos to the island go? How did you find it?
It was a very interesting cultural experience. I think because we were playing music and things like that, I had a very exciting time compared to some people who maybe might find themselves stuck there, you know, working in a sort of cycle and, you know, maybe finding it difficult to meet people. But we were straight in there. I met loads of people from Al Jazeera News Network as well, got on really well. So, it was a really interesting experience.
Okay. Well, how big is this island?
Oh, I don't know exactly how big it is. Not that big.
pretty small place.
It's still being built, really. Okay. So,
but who actually turned up to listen? What sort of stuff did you pay them?
It was very exclusive, shall we say. I mean, lots of Ferraris, lots of very expensive £2,000 dresses, and, you know, and me.
Okay. So, wow, I've been pulled out. That's really bizarre. I mean, what would you recommend it as a tourist destination? Is there anything there for anybody apart from the rich?
Most people go there to work.
Okay, just work, okay. Are there many more British people there, sort of similar to yourself, working there also?
There is definitely an expat community, yes. And actually, Qataris only make up, I believe, around 15% of the population. So 85% is actually expat or hired workforce, should we say.
Okay, interesting. Well, anyway, we're here to chat mainly about orgone energy, which most people imagine, I certainly have never heard of. What is orgone energy?
Well, orgone energy is a kind of life force or chi energy, but the actual word comes from a man called Wilhelm Reich. He actually studied under Sigmund Freud along with Carl Jung. Those are some of the names that people might remember.
Yeah.
But he's actually had a fair amount of suppression, book burnings and things like that after his death. So that's probably why a lot of people haven't heard of him, actually.
Right, so why this reaction against him?
Well, a lot of the health industry, the FDA particularly, were vehemently against his work. He was in the process of treating cancer patients, etc., with the use of orgone energy. And obviously there's not a drugs usage there. It's a very natural kind of method of curing.
So he's coming from a psycho-scientific background, and orgone energy sounds to some people possibly a bit maybe hippie-ish and to do with non-scientific issues.
Yeah, the word itself actually comes from the orgasm. Wilhelm Reich, one of his first books was The Function of the Orgasm, where he actually became quite involved with looking at the function of the orgasm, and he believed there was an energy that was created that could be measured when people had an orgasm. And that's where he first started to coin the name orgone energy.
Okay, so importantly, did he succeed in measuring it? So providing
he did. He did indeed. In fact, succeed in measuring orgone energy, and yes.
How on earth did he do that?
Well, one of the ways, it's a very difficult energy to measure, but what he did was he used to build these things called orgone accumulators, because he soon realised that this orgone energy was actually abundant throughout life, throughout everything. You couldn't get away from it, it was everywhere. But we just hadn't seen it yet, maybe because our instruments aren't very good at measuring this energy force. So what he did was he actually built these orgone accumulators, which were layered boxes of certain metals, which he called metallic and non-metallic, or organic or non-organic materials.
Okay.
And he used to use these boxes to accumulate the energy and then run series of tests to prove the existence of this energy. One of those tests was to get two identical boxes, one with the orgone accumulator shielding and the other one just a straight normal box, and measure the temperature difference. And in the one with the orgone accumulated effect, that would have a higher temperature than the one that did not have an orgone accumulation.
Okay, so he's found lots of indirect evidence and sort of strange ways actually, which might be difficult at the time for other scientists to accept.
Well, he actually wrote a letter to Einstein and showing his lab results, and Einstein ironically described it as the bombshell in physics.
Serious? Was he being ironic or serious? How'd you take that?
I think it was very serious. It was actually a very, it's a fundamental thing that, you know, would actually change a lot of the physical principles by which we operate today.
So it's something that's quite a bombshell, but we haven't quite got our heads around it. A little bit like dark matter and stuff like that. Do you think it's one of those things that...
Well, maybe dark matter is a coin for something you just can't understand it. I mean, it's a bit of a bland term, really, whereas orgone energy is actually something that can be measured and it can be put to use as well. Okay. As well as that, there's also something called DOR, deadly orgone energy. And it turns out that this energy is created by things like microwave ovens, fluorescent tubes, you know, old-style TVs.
Okay, well, we've got a fluorescent tube right here in the studio.
Yes.
So, well, on that point, let's recap Wilhelm Reich.
Wilhelm Reich, yeah.
In English, William Empire. What a name. Colin Powell discusses William Empire. See, it just gets better on this show. And that's orgone, spelt O-R-G-O-N-E. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. And you can check out some of the things. He was also doing some weather manipulation with it and also powering a motor. So the motive force was very interesting.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Colin Power, and I understand you're off to Greece soon.
I am indeed, yes.
So you'll do more guitaring.
That's it, yeah, a little bit more guitar work and stuff like that. So I'll come back when I'm back in the country and I'll let you know how it went.
Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce our sometime presenter and reporter, Anthea Page, on the line, live from the Edinburgh Festival. Hello.
Hello, I'm here with Karen De La Pena, and just seen one of her shows, which is The Fly in the Fridge. It's a brilliant show. It's a one-man show. And it's about a drug addict in New York, a hooker. And Karen plays all the parts. Anyway, I'll pass you over to her.
Hello, my name is John. I'm the presenter of Dialect Radio. How do you do?
Well, how are you?
Oh, brilliant, thank you very much. So tell me a little bit about yourself and the show. Whereabouts in Edinburgh are you, if people
we're
have
been? We're at the Apex, where the Sweetgrass Market, which is at the Apex City Hotel. In Grass Market,
okay,
in Edinburgh, and it's a 6:15, or I think maybe it's 6:20 to be exact, show. Hmm. And Anthea keeps telling me that I have to pick up the pace, so I'm going to talk ever so fast now. my name is Karen De La Pena, and
yep.
I was actually raised in this country meaning England, and then I ran away and went to the U.S. and I'm back now for the first time in I don't even know how many years performing at the Edinburgh Festival, which is kind of cool for me, hopefully for everybody else. And
yeah.
This play is something I was lucky enough to get. It's a true story, but not my story. It's a true story about a young, very privileged young woman who goes the wrong way and then finds her way back and goes very deeply and darkly the wrong way. And I play 15 characters, and it's
15?
Quite fun. 15, yeah.
Wow,
quite funny
okay.
In parts. I play black, white, young, old,
I think that beats,
female, male.
That beats Alec Guinness's record in Kind Hearts and Coronets. He played eight characters.
Yeah, I think characters. It probably does.
Some margin, well done. So what sort of preparation did you put into place to sort of play 15 characters?
A whole mess of preparations. Having lived in New York for a long time, a lot of the characters, since it's a very New York story, are accessible to me because I just met them over the years. Mm. But then also I had to work with dialecticians so that I could really nail various dialects. And I was able to workshop this piece at a really lovely jazz club up on the Upper West Side in New York City called Smoke, because the playwright is also a co-owner of a club called Smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And so every Sunday we put the play up and had basically packed houses for us to workshop. I've been able to kind of massage these characters and discover them and have a good time doing them. And so I'm springing them on the Edinburgh audience.
Okay. What sort of background in acting do you have?
I went to a school called the Arts Educational Trust, which also has denizens like Sherry Lungi, Jenny Agutter, Jane Seymour, all of whom are in my class. And I left the business for a very long time, and I'm just coming back. I just basically came back about 2 years ago in New York City.
But has there been any sort of culture shock in returning to Britain and seeing how it's changed since you were last here?
Oh, no, I've been back. I just haven't been back as an actress. So I've been steadily shocked every time I've come back because, yes, certainly since I left, which was 73, it's changed hugely. And but I mean, not in a bad way. It's just changed. You know.
And have you been to the Edinburgh Festival many times before?
Never,
actually?
Never.
Oh, okay.
30 years ago, I was supposed to be at the Edinburgh Festival. I was in a show in Paris, and the director absconded with the funds. And so, just by coincidence, exactly 30 years later, I find myself here now, and I'm so tickled. Oh, my God, this is a beautiful town. And it's just buzzing with energy and fun at the moment. And I'm here with another friend of mine who's an actress from New York as well, who's doing a piece called Mary and William. And I have about four friends here from New York, and it's been great fun just kind of hanging out. And
have you had much of a chance to see what else is
Yes, I've been seeing some other shows.
And what's big this year? What have you really enjoyed?
Well, oh gosh, I haven't seen enough to be able to tell you that. I'm just under a week here, and for the first several days I was just kind of trying to find my footing. But I just saw today a man called Martin Oldman, I think his name is, and he did something called So Sinatra, and you spell that So, comma, Sinatra. It's like, so I'm going to tell you about Sinatra, and he plays a New Jersey wise guy who grew up with Sinatra, and it's great fun. And last year, apparently, he was here playing Pierpont, who was one of the famous hangmen, and was also a solo show. So that was fun. I saw that this afternoon. And I saw a new friend of mine called Amy Abler do something called Piano Divalicious. And this woman is an extraordinary pianist and sings and does this whole thing. And I'm about to go and see Le Petit Mort, which is a young Australian woman who's put together a bunch of Strauss and Sondheim about, and a couple of other notable composers about sex. All you wanted to know about sex, but we're afraid to ask. And it's a sort of a comedy cabaret piece. And there's so much to see here, it's impossible to kind of...
Do you think you will remain acting in this country or possibly return to America? Or where do you think
I'm in the... I definitely return to America. I have a return ticket. I have a round-trip ticket. But I'm in the favorable position to be able to work here.
Yeah.
Because I'm a member of Equity. I was a kid actor. And I worked here a lot when I was a kid. And so I'm still a member of Equity. In fact, I re-upped my membership to do the Edinburgh Festival.
Okay.
And I was born here, so I don't have any work paper problems.
So you'll probably be backwards and forwards and possibly doing some more in this country in the future.
Oh, with a fair wind and a little bit of luck, absolutely.
Okay, what's the name of your show once again?
It's called The Fly in the Fridge.
The Fly in the Fridge at the Edinburgh Festival. Well, thank you very much for chatting to me, and I hope you have the rest of your run is wonderful for you.
Thanks, John. Nice talking to you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers.
Bristol has one of the richest heritages of local history of any city in Europe, and in the 1980s, the Temple Local History Group began. Over the next few weeks, we'll hear from engineer, historian and author Julian Lee Jones about one of Bristol's most authoritative and prolific history groups of recent years. Dialect's Tony Gosling tracked down the group's coordinator and asked him about the Temple Church, Temple Meads and how the group got started.
I'm Julian Lee Jones. I'm the founder, chairman, bottle washer, whatever you want to call it, for the Temple Local History Group. And we started right back in May 1980 as a group of engineers, mathematicians, scientists working for Sperry Gyroscope Research Centre down on Temple Back.
What inspired you to get interested in Bristol's local history then as an engineer?
Ignorance of Bristol's history. We happened to look out and our crescent-shaped office block, which then was called Sperry House, now it's the Crescent Centre, curves around some ruins of an old burnt-out church. And we wondered what on earth it was. And it had a leaning tower and everybody in Bristol, apart from us, knew it was the famous leaning tower of Temple Church. So we started to make inquiries as we were looking down on it from our office window. And we started making inquiries on the way up to the pub at lunchtime, and we gradually got interested in the local history.
So what did you find out about the church?
It had been blitzed during the war, 1940-41, and it wasn't a high explosive bomb, it was an incendiary bomb, and the church was locked up at the time. And the sexton's wife had just gone into hospital to give birth, and he'd locked up the church and taken the keys with him, and as a result of that they couldn't get into the church to actually get the incendiaries away in time, and so the church was gutted.
And what did you find out about the history of the place and maybe why it was leaning?
Well, there are a lot of fanciful stories about the lean, but it was the 14th and 15th century church. Was built by the Knights of St. John, the Crusader Knights of St. John, and it was built on marshy ground, its meadow, river meadows. Although the church, the ruins that you see today in the Leaning Tower, are now administered or controlled by English Heritage, what intrigued us was when we looked down from our office, third, fourth story office block, you could see a circular outline like a gravel path inside the ruined shell of the 14th century church. And that is the outline of a church of the Knights Crusader, the Templar Knights, that was there from 1145 until the Templars were dissolved. The order was dissolved in 1307, 13 to 1312. And then the land was eventually granted to the Knights of St. John, who built their own, pulled down the round Templar church, and then they built their own sort of early English-style church. In the Reformation, it survived because it was also a parish church. So it was taken over by Temple Parish, and it survived until the Hitler's bombing of 1940s.
Now, of course, that's just off Victoria Street, which is the road from the Bristol City Centre to Temple Meads. So is there a connection between the two?
Yes, because at one time, if you consider the bend of, it's now the floating harbour, but the River Avon going past from Bristol Bridge, if you go from Bristol Bridge down towards Temple Meads, down Victoria Street, the land to the left of that, bounded by the river from Temple Meads and Temple Gate, that is where one of the city gates was, and all of that land was part of the lands of the Knights Templar, given by Robert de Barclay.
What about your publications? Because it wasn't long after you started the group that you realised that you were going to be publishers.
Sperry Gyroscope UK, but it was still making high technology control systems and navigation systems. As a new company to Bristol, when they found out we were interested in sort of local history, a group of about a dozen of us initially, they were very supportive. They provided us with an office where we could store our stuff. And we started off by, as say, lunchtime walks to the pub up. And as there were only a few of us who were either Bristolians by birth or by residency, we were inundated with questions, what's this, what's that? And as a result of the embarrassment of not knowing quite often, had to do some urgent research to be able to answer these questions so as not to lose face. We then started putting our little findings on the back of the company newsletter each. We were given a paragraph, then we were given half a page, and then we actually had a page. And as I say, we joined the Avon Local History Association. So we're going after May 1980 and sort of to October that year. And before long, we realised that our discoveries and sort of researches and general curiosity were outstripping the page. And so we formed a little news sheet of our own, and we called ourselves the Sperry Local History Group. After we got about a dozen or half a dozen of these articles, we thought it'd be nice for the following Christmas, so we're talking about, I think, in the early 80s, 81 maybe, we thought we'd put all these together, photocopy them, and just put a plastic binder bar on them and produce them as Christmas presents for ourselves and our families. The firm very kindly did all the printing for us, allowed us both the time to actually put it together, and because they saw it as a community exercise, integrating the company with the community. And we put together and we printed 1,000 of these, and then family, friends and everybody else wanted. And so this was Bristol Past Revisited with Sperry Local History Group. Sadly, in 1983, Sperry UK were taken over by BA Systems and we were all made redundant. But there are enough of us left in the Bristol area to actually continue our researches. And after the sort of shock and the sort of recovery from the redundancy, we carried on. And then we actually had more sort of research, and we had a couple of major finds and discoveries, which put us on the sort of local history map. And the outcome of that was we decided to print it. We renamed ourselves as Temple Local History Group because that's where we started off our research. And we then printed it, and we actually had one of our members who was a typesetter, did all the typesetting for us, and we were put in touch with a Tame printer and a Tame book finisher, and we ended up with... a the range of A5 books, because we'd already started doing a little A5 pamphlet newsletter, which came out sort of every month or every quarter, depending how much stuff we had, and it was known as the Templar.
Well, thank you to Julian Lee Jones there. He was talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about the origins of the Temple Local History Group. More local history from Julian next week. Temple Local History Group's website is at history4u.info, which is history, the number 4, and the letter U, history4u.info.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, without further ado, it's time to introduce Doc Satori, who's going to play us a tune. What are you going to play us?
It's called My Blood, My Soul. Think of a fire burning into your eyes. Oh, if you can, imagine the flame of infernal wrath on your skin as you slide out to your mind, as you lose control of yourself, of yourself. This is what it means to be saved by your nemesis, to be bludgeoned and beaten and bound to within an inch of yourself till you cry. You can take my blood, but not my soul, not my soul. Tormented and shackled and taunted to insanity, it feels like relief. It's the price that you'll pay for a freedom imposed on your head, but not on your heart, by powers above you that you don't recognize as anything but source of control, greed, hatred and spite that will burn itself out when you cry. You can take my blood, but not my soul. When you cry, you can take my blood, but not my soul.
Ladies and gentlemen in listener land, hello.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. Whereabouts in Bristol you live in?
I'm in Victoria Park at the moment, but in the 4 years I've lived here, I've lived in just about every part of Bristol.
Right.
I've been a little itinerant.
Yeah, where are you from before that?
Well, I'm from the northwest of England. I was born in Liverpool, brought up between Wigan and St Helens. I'm right northern.
Yeah. So how do you find the difference between Scouseland and Brisland?
Quite a lot, actually. But then again, I lived in Exeter for 8 years before I moved here, so I'd had the rough edges of northernness knocked out of me, believe it or not, before I moved to Bristol. So I moved north to Bristol from the back of beyond. So,
okay, I mean, since Liverpool's had a lot of reinvestment, have you ever visited back and found it to be an alien landscape?
I've been back there and found a little bit antiseptic, which is a shame because they could have done so much better. I mean, they've made a vast improvement on that town centre, make no mistake.
Yeah.
But there's lessons to be learned there. You don't have to remove the character from a place to improve it.
When you came to Bristol, how did you come? Because I often wonder first impressions of Bristol when people emerge from the railway station at Temple Meads and see the horrible Holiday Inn. Do you remember your first impressions of Bristol?
Yeah, I do. And that was my first impression, that horrible Holiday Inn. It really was. I didn't think it was a hotel at first. I thought it was a block of flats. I thought it was council flats. It's disgusting. But, first impressions don't last that long, do they?
Yeah.
I mean, you turn the corner and you go into that lovely niceness that is Bristol.
Hmm. Okay, what inspired you to write My Blood, My Soul?
That came from the first images I saw of Guantanamo at the same time as that war of dubious legality was being waged. And the two came together into that song. That was my personal response.
Okay, what sort of things do you like to explore most, do you think, in your songwriting?
That is not typical, to be honest. I do political stuff sometimes, but I do tend to go more towards the psychological.
Ah, okay.
It's kind of insights in introspective...
Musical psychodramas.
Yeah, that kind of thing, yeah.
Interesting. Do you have a musical psychodrama for us? What would you like to play next?
Oh, well, this one is all about getting involved into something that you really are big enough to know better. What you do anyway, okay. And it's called Mist.
Okay, well, just before we hear that, if people like what they've heard, can they get in touch with you anywhere as well?
Just the standard MySpace / Doc Satori.
Okay, so that's DOC and then Satori spelled SATORI.
Yeah, right, it's all one word though, all so word, yeah.
Okay, play on.
Oh, thank you very much. Can't deny I'm losing it. I can't deny I'm losing it. Flying away from reality. My grateful lips and skin turned out to be mist, burned off by the sun. I can't deny I'm losing it. Yeah, that mist was burned off by the sun. Who am I to say what's reality? You can hide away, or you can carry on. If you believe in tomorrow, oh, believe in tomorrow. I saw them sail through the sky and I watched them disintegrate. I can't deny I'm losing it. I can't deny I'm losing it. We flew away one summer's day. You can hide away, or you can carry on. If you believe in tomorrow, oh, believe in tomorrow. Believe in tomorrow. Oh, believe. Mm-hmm. I flew away. She flew away.
Dr. Tory, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Conspiracy theories, love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of the world's most elaborate enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, he confirms the old saying that truth really can be stranger than fiction when you take the time to dig out the hard facts from behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. David doesn't pretend to have all the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to many riddles, modern and not so modern. And actor Malcolm Grieve this week reads his chapter, Lies, Damn Lies and Statistics.
Secrets and Lies, disgorged by David Southwell. We've been culturally conditioned to find arguments more believable if accompanied by statistical evidence. We tend to take on trust that when someone quotes a percentage or a cost figure, that it is accurate, and there's a widespread belief that statistics equate to facts. It was not until I started to have my first battles with Downing Street spin doctors and the British government's political advisers, such as the infamous Joe Moore, who sent an email round on 9/11 advising government press officers that it was a good day to bury bad news, that I realised how statistics could be used to lie and cover up inconvenient political truths. When you have a chance to see up close how the figures bandied around to support various arguments and claims made by governments have been manipulated to mislead the media and the public, you quickly lose your faith in the idea that any number quoted by a politician can be trusted. We know governments rarely play fair when it comes to manipulating the information at their disposal. Surveys can be constructed to give you any answer you want. Targets can always be met with a little bit of massaging. And you can avoid discussions on controversial issues by simply not collecting any figures. The same statistics those in power use to make their lies seem believable can also be used to explode long-established myths and expose information that those in government and big business definitely don't want you to know. Of all the underreported stories in the media, the one that should surprise us least about its suppression, convenient omission from news diaries, delete according to your level of cynicism, is that only just over one-fifth of us trust the media to report fairly and accurately anymore. In 1974, more than 33% of Americans and 36% of Europeans expressed a great deal of confidence in the media, according to National Opinion Research Center measures and academic studies. 20 years later, the figure has fallen to just over 10%, and in 2004, it was just under 10% who expressed the same confidence. A regular Gallup survey showed belief in the accuracy of the media falling from 54% in 1989 to 36% in 2004. The Wall Street Journal and NBC polls showed a similar decline to a figure of just 21% of Americans believing that their newspapers and broadcasters got the facts right. When Gallup also asked people to rate the honesty and ethical standards of different professions, journalists only scored higher than lawyers, politicians, and car salesmen. A recent E-Times survey showed 41% of people in America and 59% of those surveyed in the UK attributed their recent decline in trust in the media to coverage of the lead-up to an invasion of Iraq, while more than 80% of Americans said that they did not believe coverage of the presidential elections was fair and accurate. In total, only 20.5% trusted the media to tell them the truth. The former president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, Robert H. Giles, admitted, "To many, the mass media has become the massive media, intrusive, sensational, uncaring, and flawed by bias and inaccuracy. To many, we lack introspection, discipline, restraint, and a capacity for self-scrutiny." Maybe the media could start to get our trust back by beginning reports with, "We know most of you won't believe this, but..." or by quoting the secret level of trust surveys that most newspapers and broadcasters regularly conduct to find out what we think of them, but only publish if they like the results. With more than 6 billion people living today, it's hard to contemplate a time in our past when the population of the planet was reduced to just 10,000 individuals. However, Homo sapiens has come close to outright extinction, with the population falling to that genetic bottleneck figure twice in the last 100,000 years. Our ancestors were nearly wiped out in 100,000 BCE by climate change, and again in 74,000 BCE when a volcanic supereruption struck Sumatra and plunged the Earth into an instant ice age. Worryingly, statistically speaking, we are now overdue an extinction-level event. The work by statisticians looking at the likelihood of an extinction-level event reducing mankind to similar numbers again does not make for comfortable reading. According to Professor Richard Muller and Professor Robert Rode from the University of California, there is a cycle of massive extinction every 62 million years. A detailed and extensive analysis of the fossil records has backed up their theory, and even though they and colleagues across the globe have tried to knock it down, they have all failed. According to the statistics, we are now 3 million years overdue for the next extinction. If extinction does not come through the 62 million year cycle of death, it could come from a shorter geological pattern, as we are 2,500 years overdue for a massive supervolcano eruption. According to Professor Stephen Sparks of Bristol University, its fallout would cause a volcanic winter, devastating global agriculture, and causing mass starvation that would threaten the fabric of civilization. America, the country with the most potential supervolcanoes, has not got any contingency plans. Even ignoring these threats, one of the greatest minds on the planet, Stephen Hawking, Lucasian professor of mathematics at the University of Cambridge, believes that statistics show humanity is likely to be wiped out by a deadly virus. In an interview with the Daily Telegraph, he said, "I don't think the human race will survive the next 1,000 years, unless we spread into space. There are too many accidents that can befall life on a single planet." When politicians talk about the war on drugs, they are really talking about the war on some drugs. The reasons for spending billions of dollars campaigning against illegal drugs are given as preventing death and reducing crime. The secret they don't want you to know is that following this logic, the war on drugs should be extended to cigarettes and alcohol, as statistically they cause more deaths and crime than any illicit drug. In the US, the first country to declare a war on drugs, thanks to President Richard Nixon, the leading causes of death in 2000, according to the American Medical Association, were tobacco, 435,000 deaths, or 18.1% of total US deaths, poor diet and physical inactivity, 400,000 deaths, 16.6%, and alcohol, 85,000 deaths, 3.5%. All illicit drug use only accounted for 17,000 deaths, less than 1%. Perhaps aspirin should also have war declared on it, because it killed 7,600 Americans in the same period. According to the US Department of Justice, alcohol use was a factor in 4 out of 10 convicted murderers' crimes, and 2 out of 3 US prison inmates have previously been in a treatment program for alcohol dependency. By comparison, the drug cited as the most dangerous to society, crack cocaine, featured only in 1 in 10 murder convictions. There is no way of ignoring the statistical evidence that shows the $20 billion the US spent in the war on drugs in 2004 would have done a lot more to reduce deaths and crimes if spent on tackling cigarette and alcohol addiction. An even bigger statistical shock comes from discovering that although politicians quote crack cocaine as the biggest problem illicit drug, the majority of the drug-busting budget is spent on tackling marijuana. Judge Robert Sweet, the first federal judge in America to reveal openly his opposition to the drug war, revealed that, using the Department of Justice's own figures, 85% of the cost of combating drugs was taken up with marijuana, which according to him is further evidence that the use of the criminal law to deal with a drug problem is expensive, ineffective, and harmful.
That was our weekly extract from the People's Spies Non-Dodgy Dossier. That's David Southwell's book, Secrets and Lies, and many thanks to Malcolm Bree for reading it, and for David Southwell for letting us read it. It is an unadulterated pleasure to introduce, after a brief holiday, I understand, in Cornwall, Mr. Tim Burrows, the poet. Hello.
Hi.
You've been in Zenna.
Yes, had a lovely time.
Z-E-N-N-O-R?
Yes.
Okay.
And the weather's up and down, but if you head to the coast, usually the sun comes through the clouds.
Okay. Give us a short description of Zenna.
Well, Zena is a little village which is, hasn't changed at all because it's small and it's got a church and a farm and a pub, the Tinner's Arms, and it's just tiny and magical.
Well, it sounds like the ideal retreat for a poet.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, people do go there to paint and write and stuff. So.
Okay. Well, what have you got for us today?
Well, I've got two pieces. They're both about Cornwall. First one's I wrote in the Isles of Scilly in Onturo, and it was put in this year in the Lansdowne Poets Anthology. This is Sea Necklace. Nothing but the sound of sea on sand, the rhythmic slap of the waves beating on the shore, the pulse of the white moon overhead, talking to the land, bringing in salt water, gifts from the deep, kelp, rack and razor back, natural beads to fill the necklace of the sea, around the island, linking land to sky, the pulse of unity, part of you and I.
Thank you very much. I understand you also wrote a short story.
Yes, this is my take on the mermaid story. Now, there's a traditional mermaid story in Zena of a mermaid coming in and taking off to see the best local singer from the church.
Right.
So there's a carved wooden pew in the church that shows that, and there's a carved stone relief of another mermaid in the pub, so I thought
that
she
one,
deserved
that one needs
a story
of her own. Yeah.
So
okay.
This is the pub mermaid story. I saw a mermaid of stone suspended on a wall by a fireplace full of ash as echoes of Celtic jigs resounded up the chimney. As I played in the music session below, amidst the frantic tangle of fiddles, mandolins, guitars, accordion, barons, and barking dogs. The tunes made the maid lonely for the sea, to be free, not suspended on a wall of stone standing on a carved churchy rose. She cried silent tears that eroded the hard granite beneath her shining blue eyes. Until one night of side winds and storms, a gale off the star-splendid Atlantic that had rattled the bells of Zena Church, tore down the limestone chimney full of spirits from the old tin mines. The smoke from the fire swirled in the bar, halting the locals' talk of mobile mass and the village carnival. The village gazed into the smoky swirl, thought they heard a sea-filled sigh, the swish of a silver-green tail as it sped up the chimney. There'd been no such excitement since Brian drove his motorbike into an old mine shaft. Even Graham, the landlord, who was trying to call time in vain, stopped dumbstruck. Some old magic had come down off the moors from the stone circle of the dancing maidens. As the smoke cleared, everyone looked to the wall where the mermaid had been. Only the smoky outline of a small-breasted maid remained. Far off the Gurnard's Head, two sleepy fishermen checking their pots thought they heard a splash and a cry of joy as the sun suddenly broke through the grey-white cloud bank, turning the sky into a majestic silver sunset over the foaming sea that can only be found at dusk on the craggy green and yellow cliffs of Cornwall.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us. That was quite magical, and I hope the people of Zena can sort of hear that and will regale for generations to come the second story of the mermaid.
Thanks.
Thank you very much to Tim Burrows, and more from him next week. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Jeff is on holiday at the moment, so we hope he's having a good time. He hasn't sent us a postcard, mind. Starting with Tuesday, 17th of August, there is a Pride Bristol fundraiser with Never the Bride, with support from Katie Brooks at The Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and the tickets are £10 in advance. On Wednesday, the 18th of August, The Argent Dawn will be performing with support from Tides of Virtue and Ferrileave. That's at the Beer Keller in All Saints Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30, tickets are £6 in advance and £8 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and Jeff presents The Onyx. This group formed in Wadebridge in Cornwall in 1965 and released 7 singles in their career before splitting up in 1975. That's a very long gap between singles. This is the song Tamaris Khan, which originally released in 1968. Come on, this great overlord. That was the Onyx with Tamaris Khan. They were and remain one of the biggest bands to come out of Cornwall, which probably says a lot because I've never heard of them. For more information, you can check out www.the-onyx.co.uk. And for the uninformed, in case you don't know how to spell Onyx, O-N-Y-X, the-onyx.co.uk. On to Friday the 20th of August, and the UK's premier tribute to The Who, Who's Next, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol next to Muse in Bristol. The doors for that open at 7:30, and the tickets are £8 in advance. Into Saturday the 21st of August, DC Fontana will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. The doors open at 8 p.m, and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, but not least, Sunday the 22nd of August, Cars on Fire will be performing with support from Guranga, or alternatively, if you want to see some Cars on Fire, I'm sure you can just hang around somewhere south of Bristol late at night. Also, Oh No Palindromes at the Louisiana in Wapping Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m, and tickets are £4 in advance. That's all from me. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great week. And that's goodbye from Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player. It's produced by volunteers, that's us lot, and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol. Usually on a Sunday, but Ramadan's going on at the moment. So until Ramadan ends on the 12th of September, we're on Mondays at 2 p.m. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. And you can sign up for that and go to dialectradio.co.uk. There is also a lo-fi mono version of Dialect. For those of you for whom that is more convenient, you can go to bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning, or if you're outside Bristol, you can check out the BCFM website, bcfm.org.uk. Thank you very much to all our studio guests, Alan Cross and Colin Power. Thank you very much to Tim Burrows for coming in and his poem. Thank you to Jeff Sparks, away on holiday. Where's our postcard, Jeff? But he did send us a What's On Guide. Bless him, he's still vigilant as ever. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and the studio production was by Mike Noyes. The producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. Being a co-op, that means any of you can contribute. If you like the sound of what you've heard and you want to get involved, feel free to contact Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733, or you can find us on the web, bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Well, that was Dialect, and I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. From all the team in the Queen Square studio, take care. Bye-bye.